Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So the House of Representatives went home last night in a true political crisis. Speaker John Boehner had floated two different bills to reopen the government and avoid the debt ceiling deadline, but one faction or another of the House Republicans revolted in each case. The debt markets are on the brink of disarray with that deadline at midnight tonight. So where are we now? With us is John Dickerson, CBS News political director and chief political correspondent for Slate. Hi, John.
Good morning, Brian.
So the House Republican caucus wound up bickering among themselves yesterday over their own health insurance premiums, whether they would get their premiums partly paid for, like workers at most big employers, or if they would have to buy Obamacare exchange policies entirely out of pocket. Was that really the big sticking point?
Well, there were a couple of big sticking points. I mean, the big sticking point is that the conservatives who launched this adventure were looking at the options, what they were going to get for it in the end, and it was basically pitiful. And the two things on the table were what you very nicely described, the so-called Vitter Amendment. And there was a debate about whether Obamacare would apply only to members or members and their staff. And so that was the nature of the debate. Originally, it was just to the members, and then leadership sought to expand it to their staff to see if that would bring in some more votes to get the magical 218. It didn't. Another gambit that was tried was a delay in the medical device tax for 2 years of a funding mechanism for the Affordable Care Act. And there are a lot of supporters for delaying that tax. But there are also quite a lot of opponents, particularly in the very conservative part of the Republican ranks, who see that as a victory for K Street, essentially, and the lobbyists of these big medical device manufacturers. And they were looking at this and saying, this crusade we started in the name, in part, of the middle class, the only victory we're getting out of it is something that corporations want. They revolted. That was dropped. They couldn't get 218. The whole thing collapsed.
So where are we this morning? Has anything happened in the last few hours?
We have had significant development in the last few hours, which is that Speaker Boehner will put the Senate agreement on the floor first, which is a big defeat. And the Senate agreement is still the ink is drying, or they may, in fact, still be putting the final touches on it. The Senate agreement essentially is to open the government through January 15th, lift the debt ceiling through February 7th, have a budget committee that would be required to have a report by the middle of December. And then it would also do a few other things, deliver back pay to furloughed workers, require income verification for those signing up in the health exchanges, and that's about it. And so that's being worked out in the Senate. The Senate will meet at noon, and then it will go over the House, and they will have a House vote that, as of the last few minutes, according to some GOP aides I talked to, it looks like it will pass, but probably with just the bare minimum of Republican votes and then a whole lot of Democratic votes.
So is Boehner having to choose by putting the Senate compromise, assuming there really is a Senate compromise, up for a vote in the House, choose between letting the government default or bringing a bill to the floor that Democrats will help pass but his Tea Party caucus will vote no on?
That's exactly right. The question was always, the Tea Party caucus, or the very hardest center of that caucus, about 33 members, was basically always going to vote against whatever bill could get out of the House and also get a presidential signature. So it was always going to get some number of Tea Party votes against him. The question is now, though, he could get a huge defection of Republicans. And so what number is actually, you know, is he, how many is he going to lose? If you look at some past votes, the number is about, he could, you know, there are 26 Republicans who voted last year for three measures that are that were the most contentious, the relief funding for Sandy, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, and the fiscal cliff. There were that number of Republicans who voted with the Democrats. And so if you look at that, that number, that would pass the Senate bill. So that's sort of the question is whether that is a ceiling or a floor. that number of Republicans, 23 Republicans. Is that the minimum number that will vote for this, or will some more? But whatever the number is, it's probably not likely to be a majority of the Republican conference.
John Dickerson, CBS News political director and chief political correspondent for Slate, also joining us now, NPR congressional correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tamara. You're on the Hill, right?
I am on the Hill.
What
I am,
is
and it
happening?
Feels a little... It feels a little hungover here on the House side, actually. Things are very slow over here, in part because the action is over in the Senate, and that action is all happening behind closed doors at this point. There's a sense that we will be hearing something soon from the Senate. It's just not, we just haven't heard it yet, so it's kind of quiet.
John was saying he was hearing from his GOP sources that whatever comes out of the Senate, Speaker Boehner will put it up for a vote in the House, even if they don't get a Republican majority, a majority of the majority, to vote for it. Are you hearing any such thing?
You know, I haven't heard confirmation of that. I think that the officialdom is being cautious at this point and waiting to see exactly what the deal is. But that is the sense that this will go down, as he said, much like the Violence Against Women Act or the fiscal cliff deal or several other of these, the Sandy funding, where ultimately it has to pass with both Democratic and Republican support. I mean, frankly, that's anything that comes out of the Senate has to pass that way in the House, because there are about 30 members who basically won't vote for anything, 30 Republicans.
Let me ask you both about some of the individuals rising in the end game of this round of permanent government by crisis. Paul Ryan is one, the House Budget Committee chairman, who is Mitt Romney's running mate and had that radical budget plan last year that didn't go anywhere. And three more moderate Republican women senators trying to forge a compromise, Susan Collins especially, and getting enough buy-in from the more conservative Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire. Here is Ayotte, followed by Collins on the Today Show this morning.
I'm not for a losing strategy, although I don't support Obamacare. I didn't think any of us here thought that this was going to succeed, and obviously it's failed. Let's face it, the government shut down, the Obamacare exchanges opened. What we need is problem solving. That's why I'm proud to be here with Susan and Lisa to get this resolved for the country.
We put together a bipartisan group. I think it's significant that it's led by women, but even more significant is the fact that it's six Republicans and six Democrats, and we've come to an agreement.
The unmistakable voice of Susan Collins, our Maine. Kelly Ayotte before her are New Hampshire, both on the Today Show. So, Tamara Keith, do you think we're seeing something of the female tendency to collaborate more and compete less than men coming into play here?
Oh, you ask me this.
I'll ask everybody this. John, well, get ready.
I do think that certainly that discussion that began with Senator Collins got the mood set for some sort of bipartisan solution. Ultimately, what she had been proposing is not going to be the solution, and now we're down to two very powerful men working together. But I think that
that's Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell, exactly. But certainly it. She got the ball rolling and got people talking about it and thinking about it.
John?
I think that's right. In the sort of, if you go back to last Friday, when things seemed kind of frozen everywhere, the Senate stepped up and this group of with Susan Collins and the six Democrats started the process. Of course, that collapsed on Saturday when Harry Reid basically put the kibosh on the Collins proposal, and then those six Democrats backed off because the Collins proposal would have funded the government through March, allowing a new round of sequestration cuts to kick in January, which Democrats were very much against. So got the ball rolling, but if you're looking for Republicans taking a big risk, I think Mitch McConnell has to come pretty far on the top of the list because he faces, of course, re-election. He has a Tea Party challenger. A lot of the people driving the bus in this crisis are not fans of Mitch McConnell. And here McConnell is the one who worked with Harry Reid, to get this compromise that is now going to be the exit ramp for everyone, and that will reopen the government and avoid a debt ceiling breach. So,
do you think, John, that that's a political calculation or an act of courage? It's an act of courage if he thinks it's going to be unpopular in Kentucky and that it's going to strengthen the Tea Party challenger in the primary. It's you know, maybe somewhat of an act of courage, but also an act of political pragmatism if he thinks that people, even in Kentucky, are so fed up with this that since he has to run for office statewide, that this is a net plus or at least a net even.
Correct. It's both. There are a number of political reasons to do this. A, you make the point about Kentucky and it being statewide. B, Mitch McConnell has a chance to be the majority leader of the Senate if Republicans win in what was otherwise, and before this, a pretty favorable landscape for Republican Senate candidates across the country. Not a slam dunk by any means, but a relatively favorable landscape that is now, in terms of statewide votes, it's not just in Kentucky, it's in all those other states where Republicans could have had a shot. So Mitch McConnell's chance at either being majority leader again or being in a Senate where there's a very small Democratic majority is hanging in the balance here. And also he's hearing from the majority of his Senate colleagues, Kelly Ayotte and Susan Collins and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, and basically a big majority of the caucus was saying this is a horrible strategy before we ever embarked upon it, and now we're seeing the Republican Party's approval ratings as low as they've ever been historically in several polls.
And we heard it in the Kelly Ayotte clip. So I'm not for a losing strategy, though I don't support Obamacare. I didn't think any of us here thought this would succeed, and obviously it's failed. The government has shut down, and the exchanges are open, the Kelly Ayotte clip that we just played. NPR's Tamara Keith on the Hill. Politico is reporting now that the House will vote first on an emerging Senate proposal to open the government and lift the debt ceiling. Do you understand why the House would go first on what is a Senate proposal if Politico is accurate here?
Yeah, and I think we need to be careful to say if they're accurate, because one House leadership source I spoke with said that it was a rumor started by Nancy Pelosi. It could still be true, but, you know, I want to be cautious there. But there is a very good reason for the House to go first. It can sort of grease the skids. If the House goes first, they can send it over to the Senate with a priority and basically speed up the process, avoid some of these 30-hour waiting periods that are part of what makes the Senate the greatest deliberative body ever, and speed up the process. So that's why the House would go first.
The greatest deliberative body ever on that side of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., U.S. of A. Tamara Keith, congressional correspondent for NPR with us. Also John Dickerson, CBS News political director and chief political correspondent for Slate. Our phones are open, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to get in on the fast-moving developments and say anything or ask anything about them, 212-433-9692. And also joining us now is WNYC business editor Charlie Herman. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Brian.
So let's check bond prices, Charlie. This is one of the big fears right now, that tonight's unresolved debt ceiling deadline could send U.S. Treasuries reeling worldwide, setting off massive disruption eventually, since they're supposed to be the safest investment in the world. So the markets opened here last hour, and
well, what we're seeing in particular in the stock market is that it's actually jumped up quite a fair amount, and that is this belief that there is going to be a settlement. Yesterday, from a bond point of view, what we saw was that those interest rates rose, and basically this meant that the government had to offer more, or there had to be more of a return in the future for people to come and buy those bonds, and people weren't that interested. What we're seeing pretty consistently is institutions like Citigroup, like BlackRock, like JP Morgan, talking about how they are not holding on to short-term treasuries that are going to be due in the next couple of weeks because they're afraid that the government might run into some ability to pay them back. So as a result, some of the short-term debt that we just saw, we've seen some higher interest rates. But, you know, this could all change on a dime if there is a deal that is made. I mean, we're seeing this right now. The stock market is sort of the immediate temperature gauge. And every time that there's talk of a possible deal being reached in Congress, you see it shoot up. We haven't seen it gone down as much when talks fail. Right now it's up. So that's their perspective.
And the ratings agency Fitch Fitch has put the U.S. government on a credit watch. And that's not a downgrade from the AAA rating, Charlie. What is it?
It's basically saying we may downgrade you. We are watching you and seeing what is going to happen out of Washington. And one of the things to keep in mind is the Fitch report did stress that this is not necessarily a question of whether or not the government can actually pay its bills in the future, and it believes that the government can. It's more a reflection on the politics and the way in which decisions are being made about how government is being funded, and not necessarily calling into question, you know, the solvency of the United States. It's not a situation like we saw in Europe or some other countries where they really had a problem actually paying the debt. This is more political, which is also troubling as well, too.
Does Fitch matter, by the way? People are used to hearing the name Standard & Poor's or Moody's. Maybe not so much Fitch,
not
unless
so much,
they're more on the inside.
More on the inside. I mean, it's important when a rating agency basically says, we have questions about your ability to pay your bills. At the same time, when Standards & Poor did this 2 years ago, there was a lot of worry about the effect that it would have. There was some increase in borrowing costs for the United States. At the same time, the market did pretty well afterwards, and the economy continued to grow. So there's a little bit of this may not be as big of a deal as the man on the street may not have as much of an impact on them. At the same time, you know, it just more from a global perspective keeps reinforcing this point of view that the U.S. can't get its house in order to pay its bills.
And the ratings agencies themselves were so discredited after the financial
crisis. That's a whole other question.
Who knows whether or not any of this actually means. Maybe they're trying to, you know, build some credibility here. Who knows? John Dickerson, we have a tweet here from Amy Davidson at The New Yorker. Maybe you saw it this morning, who wrote, "So today's the day when people of goodwill hope that the GOP really is enthralled to Wall Street." You get it?
I do. My nerves are a little desensitized at this stage in the game. Essentially, that was always the the brick wall at the back of all of this, particularly on the debt ceiling, was that John Boehner and House leadership basically always knew they were going to bring something up at the end to avoid a breach of the debt ceiling. I mean, that was always kind of something that the Speaker had said out loud. He'd said it in private. It's what his aides were saying. Now, the bill is not on the floor, so we should remain skeptical until the votes are cast and the bill is on the floor. But the question was always, if he was always going to put something on the floor, what's the best thing he could get to put on the floor that would keep a breach from happening, but that would at least win something for his members? And right now, it looks like if the reporting is true and what I'm hearing is true, and there's going to be a vote on the Senate version, he's getting almost the weakest possible thing he could get, next to a simple clean lifting of the debt ceiling and extension of government funding.
But Tamara Keith, to the truth behind, you know, Amy Davidson's quip in that tweet, there really is a Tea Party faction that is not as enthralled to Wall Street as Republican members of Congress usually are, that it doesn't even believe Wall Street when they say that the debt ceiling breach might actually be catastrophic, right?
Yeah, there are a number of default deniers out there. And there's also a concern about crony capitalism. I mean, the Tea Party rose out of outrage over TARP and outrage over the Republican Party, President Bush at the time, and Republicans in Congress going along with TARP. And that would be the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the bank bailout. These folks are not taking calls from Wall Street and saying, oh, yeah, absolutely, let's go along. They're not really great friends. So the dynamic is different with those folks. So that is certainly something that changes it. And also, they really, truly do not believe that default is a bad thing, or that it will even happen. And they're very focused on technical default, which would be failing to pay service on the debt. And they do not consider failing to put out Social Security checks or pay other bills to be default. And technically it wouldn't be, but the effect, according to the economists we talked to, could be exactly the same.
And we could try to crowdsource the Wall Street reporting here as part of what we do on the phones. Those of you who work in the markets or have experience with them, what's happening and what's going to happen or could happen with Congress so near this fiscal and psychological cliff? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take a call right now. George in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, George.
Well, hi. I was just typing into your computer thread. But listen, is there a number? Are there some numbers that I'm missing here? How much money is being authorized to be spent by the budget between now and whenever it's supposed to not be spent? And how much debt is being authorized to be accommodated by raising the ceiling? No one's saying anything about it. You haven't said anything about it the whole time.
George, good question. Charlie, do you have the answer to those?
Well, what this question about a deadline happening tonight has to do more with the fact that the government has already hit the debt limit, the amount of money that it can actually legally spend, and has been using these extraordinary measures to continue to try and pay a lot of bills that have been coming due. So come tonight, the Treasury Secretary has basically said, we have about $30 billion in cash. And a way I heard a great description of it this morning was, it's sort of like you have a credit card, it's been maxed out, and now you're left with about $30. And you can still spend that money over the next couple of weeks, but you have a lot of bills that are coming in, and you have to make decisions about which ones to pay. So some of the proposals, and Tamara and Jonathan can probably talk about this more, would extend the ceiling, the amount of money that the government could borrow until February. The thing to keep in mind is, yes, by extending the debt ceiling, whether it's $1 trillion, whether it's $500 million, whatever it is, yes, we will be taking on more debt. But the reality is, we've already incurred these costs. We've already purchased the car, purchased the house, and now the bill is due. So in a way, it's sort of we have the product already. We have to pay for it.
And John Dickerson, one of the issues hanging up the House last night, and maybe the nation's last Hail Mary pass before default, I don't know, involves flexibility on the government's part once the debt ceiling deadline is reached. So how much room do they have to maneuver after midnight tonight, to George's question, without actually failing to pay any bills?
Well, I guess there are a couple of things. One, as a part of the agreement, there was some discussion about trying to tie the hands of the Treasury Secretary if the debt ceiling is breached on the new deadline of February 7th. That looks like it's fallen out, and so the Treasury Secretary will be able to keep doing what he's been doing for the last several months.
In other words, some version of this flexible credit has already been going on since around May, and this kind of window from May to October, some of the more hardcore Republicans in the House want to take that flexibility away for future debt ceiling deadlines?
Right, and so that the ceiling is really a, you know, super hard thing that can be used to then squeeze concessions in a budget negotiation. But then there's the question of prioritization that would kick in sometime around the 17th of October. And so the Treasury and the administration admits that, to continue with the analogy, they can reach into the pocket for the $30, and they can maybe make that first payment. But the minute they reach into the pocket, the markets, which are the big worry here, it's not technically whether they can take the $30 out of their pocket. It's that reaching into the pocket itself is such an extraordinary act and precipitates even more extraordinary and disastrous acts that the market would react with an immense spasm that would hurt the economy severely. And so it's really not, as the administration makes the case, it's not technically an issue whether they can sort of deal with this prioritization for a day or two or three or four. It's that even if they start that process, it has the negative economic effects that will be devastating.
Connie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Connie.
Hi. I think there's a little bit of confusion about what is default and what is technical default.
Mm-hmm.
I think I heard somebody say that not paying the not servicing the debt was just technical default. It wasn't really default. And that's not true. Technical default is if you fail to file a little notice or something like that. But anything that has to do with money is default, period.
You work in the markets?
I used to. I used to work as a credit analyst, actually, for Moody's.
Right. Thank you, Connie. And Tamara Keith, to the point you were making before about this, that some members of Congress feel it wouldn't be default as long as they continue to pay the interest on the debt. If they stop paying Social Security payments at the end of the month, for example, that would not be default. Are members of Congress really willing to stop making Social Security payments to make their political point?
Not really, though they would then say that that was President Obama's choice, that he would have chosen to pay something else instead of making the Social Security payments. I mean, I think that it's sort of a one hopes going to be a moot argument. But I will say that it's not like all of House Republicans. We're talking about a very small subsection of people who would fall into this category. I think it's not fair to paint Republicans broadly with that brush. It's really just a handful of folks who are kind of loud or at least get interviewed a lot.
And numerous enough to hold up a bargain?
I think that this train is leaving the station, and I think many of them at this point realize that. Once House Speaker John Boehner, and, you know, we aren't certain of this, leadership hasn't met yet, but it seems like it's going this way. Once House Speaker John Boehner is willing to bring a compromise bill to the floor, they pretty much lose their power because there really only are about 30 of them. And if the speaker is willing to take that political risk and allow Democrats largely to pass a bill, then the Tea Party opposition loses its power, at least briefly, because they simply don't have the numbers.
Robert in Yonkers has a point about that. Robert, you're on WNYC.
Hi, yeah. How you doing? I'd like to see Nancy Pelosi make a deal with Boehner and say, hey, bring a clean CR, and then when they revolt, then we'll help you get reelected as Speaker.
Aha. Uh-huh. John Dickerson, do you think that's a possibility? There's a revolt because Dickerson brings a bill that doesn't have the majority of the Republicans in support. Then there's a vote of no confidence in him as Speaker. A majority of Republicans vote against Boehner for some more conservative Republican, but the Democrats actually vote to retain Boehner as Speaker. Do you see that as plausible?
It's an exciting theory. I think the problem with it, though, is that there just aren't enough Republicans to oust Boehner. That's one problem, and two, there's no alternative to him. So there might be a leadership challenge. There was one before, and it got a piddling number of votes. You have this core, powerful, but very limited group of sort of Tea Party Republicans, and then there are circles outside of that of people who are kind of more or less aligned with them on various issues. But when it comes to a speakership challenge, you need a majority, and there's just not a majority to throw Boehner out. There are a lot of Republicans who understand the very difficult hand he was dealt and was trying to play and what he was trying to do. It looks like a disaster from the outside, but for a lot of Republicans, what they saw is a leader trying to keep the conference together, trying to accommodate all the views, trying to press the White House with as little leverage as he had. And so there's not a huge desire to throw him overboard. And even if there were, you'd have to find an alternative, and one doesn't really exist.
John in Clark, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hello, sir. How are you? Thank you so much for taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point that Barack Obama made when he was a senator, and that it's really unfair to our children, our children's children, to live off of them, and just because they're the ones ultimately that are going to be paying this debt. So I'm totally for the debt ceiling. I think by taking 25% across the board, we can all kind of suck it up. I mean, I know I have. I've been in the private sector. I've taken some serious hits. I know a lot of other people, other Americans, have done the same. So I don't think it's unfair to ask our representatives to live within our means. I think we may not agree where the cuts may come from, but I certainly think we need to bring this down.
You understand, John, that the debt ceiling is for debts that were already incurred by past spending decisions by Congress, right?
I understand that. I don't know all the particulars. I know we take over $200 billion a year, and I know our debt service, our actual debt service, not all our obligations, as it seems to be lumped together, can be paid. I think if we brought it down, spending down to 25%, which would be around 2001 spending levels, we can turn this around. And I understand. There's a lot of people who would be hurt, but you know what? I mean, people may have to move into other people's homes. I understand that. But, you know, we put ourselves in this situation, and I think it's unfair to transfer this to our children and our children's children.
John, thank you. And so, Tamara, I think we still don't know the number. Is there a number that that is a number of dollars that the ceiling has to be lifted to in order to continue to pay the interest on accumulated debts? And if Congress were to draw a line here and say, okay, this is the point where we just don't borrow any more money and we pay the debt so we don't go into default in a banking sense, but now we stop borrowing additional money and just cut the budget by that much, what would it really mean?
Well, so obviously this is a fantasy discussion because what's being discussed now is raising the debt ceiling through early February. And it actually would not be by a dollar amount, but would be by a date, is my understanding. So a suspension of the debt limit until early February. Last year, our deficit was about $640 billion as a nation. That's the amount of money that we have to borrow to pay our bills above and beyond what we bring in. So that's the amount by which the debt ceiling had to rise last year to continue, plus some debt services and some other stuff. So it's not a precise amount. The cuts would be significant. And the other thing to talk about here is that thus far, as we've gone along, almost all of the cuts that have happened through sequester and all of these other things have been to discretionary spending, defense and non-defense discretionary spending, which is actually not the bulk of our budget. It's the bulk of what we often think of as our government spending. But in reality, the biggest amount of government spending goes to so-called entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. That's where the big dollars are. And in the long run, that's where the big rise in government spending
will be. And that's the big conversation for the big grand bargain or the mini bargain or whatever might come next out of all of this. And we leave it there for now. We thank WNYC business editor Charlie Herman.
Thank you.
NPR congressional correspondent Tamara Keith.
Thank you.
And John Dickerson, CBS News political director and chief political correspondent for Slate. By the way, are you still doing those extra gab fests every day on Slate with your great colleagues? These chats every day that the government shutdown is continuing.
We are every day. We did one last night. We'll do one tonight, and as long as this thing continues.
And we will keep following it. Thank you all, Brian Lehrer, WNYC.